Familiar rattle. A breeze. Thank God. I flipped the wall light switches as I walked toward the kitchen at the back of the house, half of them working, half not. Daniel wasn't here. Nobody was here. I turned the deadbolt, but the wood around it was rotted and splintered, the bolt cutting through the frame whether it was locked or not. Everything looked as I'd left it. A box on the table, a used glass in the sink. Everything coated in a fine layer of dust. The ring. I took the steps two at a time and went straight for the nightstand, my fingers trembling as I reached inside the ceramic bowl, frantic heartbeats until my finger brushed metal. The ring was there. It was fine. I slid it back on my finger and ran my shaking hand through my hair. Everything's fine. Breathe. The bed was still bare, but the sheets were folded and stacked on top, the way Daniel used to leave them when he started taking over for the things Mom couldn't do. I moved the shoeboxes back to the closet, and the rug back under the legs of the bed. I centered the jewelry box under the mirror, a dust-free square where it had sat for the last year at least. Everything resettling. Realigning. I felt the memories doing the same, falling back into place. The investigation. All I'd left behind, neatly boxed away for 10 years. I looked around my room and saw the rectangles of discolored paint. I closed my eyes and saw the pictures that had hung in each spot. My stomach churned, unsettled. Corinne had been in every one. A coincidence, I thought. Corinne was so wrapped up in my childhood, I could probably find her shadow in anything here if I went looking for it. I needed to find out what thought had surged and then faltered, driving Dad to a sheet of paper and an envelope with my name. What memory had been flickering from the dying portion of his brain, begging for attention before it faded away for good? Corinne. Alive. But when? I had to find out. Everything was stuck here, waiting for someone to step in and reorder the evidence, the stories, the events, until they came together in a way that made sense. In that way, Dad was right. About time. About the past being alive. I walked down the wooden steps into the kitchen, the linoleum shrinking away from the corners, and imagined, for a moment, catching sight of a girl with long bronze hair, her laughter echoing through the night as she skipped up the steps of the back porch. Tick-tock, Nick. I had to focus, make sense of this house and get out, before the past started creeping out from the walls, whispering from the grates, before it unpacked itself from that box, layer after layer, all the way back to the start. Part 2. Going back. It is quite true what philosophy says, that life must be understood backwards. Soren Kierkegaard. 2 weeks later. Day 15. If I kept my eyes closed, I could almost imagine that we were driving back to Philadelphia. Everett in the driver's seat and the back seat full of luggage and Coulee Ridge fading away in the rearview mirror. No missing girls, no unmarked cars circling town. Nothing at all to fear.
You okay?
He asked. Just one more moment. I wanted more time. Another minute to pretend this wasn't happening. Not here in Coulee Ridge. Not again. Not another girl fading away in these woods in the middle of the night, disappearing without a trace. Not another missing poster stapled to the trees, hung in the storefront windows. Another innocent face asking to be found. Please, not like this. But the back of my neck prickled as the world shifted into focus, and there she was, inescapable, her huge blue eyes staring out from under the red, missing letters of the poster on the telephone pole. Annalise Carter. Gone.
Nick?
Everett said. God, a few days in this place, and apparently he's calling me Nick, too. It got its claws in him already. Yeah, I said, still looking out the window. My eyes caught hers again at the next stoplight, her face under the white painted letters of Julie's boutique, right next to a display of handmade jewelry and a green silk scarf. Annalise Carter, whose property backed to my own, who had been dating my ex-boyfriend the night she disappeared. Annalise Carter, gone and missing for 2 weeks.
Hey.
Everett's hand hovered over my shoulder before he pressed down and squeezed.
You with me?
Sorry, I'm fine. I turned toward Everett, but I felt her gaze on the back of my neck, like she was trying to tell me something. Look. Look closer. Do you see?
I'm not leaving until I know you're okay.
His hand rested on my shoulder, his silver watch, steel, he'd told me, peeking out from his long-sleeved button-down. How was he not sweltering? I thought that was the purpose of the appointment. I raised the paper prescription bag at Everett. I'll take two and call you in the morning. I mustered a smile, but his expression tightened as his eyes settled on my bare finger. I dropped my hand back to my lap. I'll find the ring, I said.
I'm not worried about the ring. I'm worried about you.
Maybe he was talking about the way I looked, hair thrown back in a messy ponytail, shorts that had fit 2 weeks ago but were now hanging off my hip bones, an old T-shirt I'd found in my closet where it had been hanging for the last 10 years. Meanwhile, his hair was cut and styled, and he was dressed for work like this was all part of the agenda. Take Nicolette to the doctor because she hasn't been sleeping, follow up on paperwork regarding future father-in-law, take cab to airport and prepare for trial. Everett, honestly, I'm fine. He reached over and brushed back the wisps of hair that had escaped my ponytail.
Really?
He said. Yes, really. My eyes burned as they drifted back to Annalise's picture. Only a sane person would realize how close he or she was to the edge. Not like my dad, who didn't know when he was teetering too close to that chasm, didn't seem to notice the change in velocity as he went tumbling into the abyss. But I knew. I knew how close we all were to that edge. And if I knew, then I was fine. Those were the basic rules of holding one's shit together, according to Tyler.
Nicolette, I don't want to leave you here alone.
A car behind us laid on the horn and Everett jumped, revving the motor of my car as he sped through the green light. I stared at the side of his face, watched the road blur past behind him. I'm not alone. My brother's here. Everett sighed, and I could hear the argument in his silence. Missing girls had a way of working their way into someone's head. You couldn't help but see them in everyone, how temporary and fragile we might be. One moment here, and the next, nothing more than a photo staring from a storefront window. It was a feeling that settled in your ribs and slowly gnawed at you from the inside, the irrational fear that people were slipping away right before your eyes. I felt it, lingering just under the surface in the haunting monotone of Tyler's voicemail recording and in Daniel's increasingly unreadable expression. I felt it with greater urgency every time I walked into Grand Pines. 2 weeks back in Cooley Ridge, and everyone in danger of disappearing. Everett pulled into the gravel driveway, parked, and got out of the car without speaking. He was staring at the front of the house, like I'd done when I first arrived home. I need to get my dad out of Grand Pines, I said, walking toward him. Everett had stopped the cops from questioning Dad for the time being, but I knew it was only a matter of time before his ramblings about that girl earned him another visit from detectives desperate for a lead. Everett put a hand around my waist as we walked inside. I felt him grasping the loose fabric of my shirt between his fingers.
You need to take care of yourself right now. The doctor said
there's nothing wrong with me. Everett had insisted on coming into the exam room with me. First, the doctor asked about my family history, which was depressing but unrelated. Then came the when did it start question, and Everett answering about Annalise, my neighbor who went missing, and the doctor nodding like he understood. Stress, fear, either, both. He scribbled a prescription for some anti-anxiety medicine and a sleeping aid and issued a warning about my mind getting duller, slower, if I didn't start getting some more sleep, and the elevated risk for daytime blackouts the longer this went on, which was how Everett ended up with my keys. You try sleeping, I wanted to tell the doctor. You try sleeping when there's another missing girl and the police are trying to question your father, whether he's in his right mind or not. You try sleeping when you know someone has been in your house. As if everything would settle down if I could just relax. Everett was still holding me like I might float off into the atmosphere otherwise.
Come home with me,
he said. But where was home, really? I can't. My dad...
I'll take care of it.
I knew he would. It was why he was here. The house, I said, gesturing to the broken-down boxes in the corners, the back door that needed fixing, all the items on my list that I hadn't tackled. He shook his head.
I'll pay to have someone help finish up. Come on. You don't need to be here.
But I shook my head again. It wasn't the organizing or the fixing or the cleaning. Not anymore. I can't just leave. Not in the middle of this. This being the wide eyes of the girl in the poster, watching us all, on every telephone pole, in every store window. This being the investigation, just beginning. This being the darkest parts of my family about to be broken open yet again. Everett sighed.
You called me for advice, and here it is. It's not safe for you here. This place, the cops are circling it like goddamn vultures, grasping anything they can. They're interviewing people without cause. It doesn't make sense, but it doesn't change the fact that it's happening.
Everett didn't get why, but I did. Annalise had sent a text to Officer Stewart's personal cell the night before she disappeared, asking if he could answer some questions about the Corinne Prescott case. His return call the next day went straight to voicemail. By then, she was already gone. The cops were all from around here, had been here 10 years ago when Corinne disappeared, or they'd heard stories through the years over drinks at the bar. Now there were two girls, barely adults, disappearing without a trace from the same town. And the last known words from Annalise were about Corinne Prescott. It made perfect sense if you came from a place like Coulee Ridge. If the entirety of Corinne's official investigation existed inside that single box I pictured at the police station, I'd imagine this was all the evidence you would see. One pregnancy test, stuffed into a box of candy and hidden at the bottom of the trash can. One ring with remnants of blood pulled from the caverns. Cassette tapes with hours of interview reports to sort through. Facts and lies and half-truths wound up in a spool. Corinne's phone records and names. Names scrawled on ripped-up pieces of paper, enough pieces to pad the entire box like stuffing. Until recently, I imagined that this box was taped up and hidden in a corner behind other, newer boxes. But now there's the feeling that all it would take is a simple nudge for it to topple over and the lid to fall free, and the names to scatter across the dusty floor. The box is exactly like it is in Coulee Ridge. The past, boxed up and stacked out of sight, but never too far away. Open the top because Annalise mentioned Corinne's name and disappeared. Close your eyes and reach your hand inside. Pull out a name. That's how it works here. That's what's happening. Yes, I had called Everett for advice. For my dad. He could have told me what to do about the cops who were ambushing my senile father at his nursing home, but he hopped a plane 3 days ago and paid a ridiculous amount of cab fare and set up his own base of operations in the dining room. He showed up at this house and stood on the front porch because he said I'd scared him, and I loved him for it. I loved that he came, but I couldn't dig through our history with him here. Couldn't figure out what the hell had happened to Annalise without dragging him into it. My advice to him, leave. Leave before we pull you down with us. It's my family, I said.
I don't want you staying here,
he whispered, pointing to the backyard that stretched as far as we could see, disappearing into the trees.
A girl went missing from right there.
I'll take that prescription and I'll try to sleep more. I promise. But I have to stay. He kissed my forehead and mumbled into my hair.
I don't know why you're doing this.
Wasn't it obvious? She was everywhere I looked. On every telephone pole, in every store window, the same place as I'd hung posters of Corinne, stapling them with a knot in my stomach, handing them out faster and faster as if my speed could somehow change the outcome. Annalise on those posters now, with her huge open eyes, telling me to open mine. Everywhere I looked, there she was. Look. Look. Keep your eyes open. The taxi company said a car would arrive in 20 minutes, but I guessed it would be more like 40. Everett was leaning against the laundry room door jamb, watching me dump his clothes from the dryer into the warped plastic bin with half a smile on his face.
You don't have to do that, Nicolette.
I cleared my throat and balanced the laundry basket on my hip. I want to, I said. I wanted to fold his clothes and pack them up and kiss him goodbye. I wanted him to get home and open his suitcase and think of me. But I also just wanted him to go. He watched me fold his clothes into perfect squares on the dining room table, and then he watched me stack them in his suitcase, as if performing a delicate surgery.
See if you can break your lease,
he said, striding toward me, wrapping his arms around my waist as I folded his last shirt. He brushed my ponytail to the side and put his lips against my neck.
I want you living with me as soon as you're back.
I nodded and kept my arms moving. It should be easy for me to say yes. Of course, yes. It should be easy for me to envision. Me with my clothes taking up half his closet. Us cooking together in his kitchen, curled up on his couch with the red throw blanket over my legs because he kept the temperature about 5 degrees cooler than I liked it. Him talking about court, and me talking about my students as I poured 2 glasses of wine.
What's the matter?
Everett asked. Nothing, just thinking of everything I need to do here first.
Do you need anything?
He asked, stepping back. He cleared his throat, tried to make his voice seem natural.
Money?
I flinched. He'd never offered me money. We'd never even talked about money. He had it, and I didn't, which meant we circled the topic like a fire that could quickly burn out of control and consume us both. It was why I never brought up the wedding, because then he'd have to mention the prenup that I knew his dad would demand I sign, and I would, but there it would be, out in the open, ready to burn. No, I don't need your money, I said.
That's not what I... Nicolette, I just meant I can help. Please let me help.
He'd told me, back when we first met, that I was the embodiment of everything he wished he could be. Setting out in a car by myself, working my way through school, self-made. But as I'd told him back then, you have to come from nothing to have that chance. You have to pay your debts. Yeah, well, I have 10 years worth of loans, I'd said. Sometimes I wondered if, when we got married, he would pay them off. If that would make me a different person. If he'd like me quite as much. Everett, thank you. But money isn't going to help. I zipped up his suitcase and leaned it against the wall. I heard a car turn off the road in the distance. Your cab's here, I whispered, bringing my arms around his waist and resting my head against his chest again.
Think about it?
He asked, pulling back. I wasn't sure which he was referring to, moving in with him or taking his money, and I hated that he was bringing both up right now, that it took this, seeing me here, hovering near some indefinable edge that made him seem to want me more. Okay, I said, and from the look on his face, I wondered if I had just unintentionally agreed to something.
I wish I could stay longer,
he said, pulling me into a kiss.
But I'm glad I got to meet your family.
I laughed. Yeah, good thing.
I'm serious,
he said. Then lower.
They're good people.
Yeah, I whispered, and I let him pull me in so tight I'd probably have indentations from the lines of his collar on my cheek. So are you, I said as he released me. He dragged his hands down my arms as he backed away and lifted my left hand to his face.
I'll file a claim tomorrow.
It might still turn up, I cringed. It's probably in one of those half-packed boxes. I'll look again.
Let me know if you find it,
he said, pulling his suitcase behind him toward the door.
And Nicolette?
My heart stopped from the way he was looking at me.
If you're not home by next weekend? I'm coming back for you.
After watching his cab drive off, I shut the door behind me, turned the lock, and twisted the knob to double-check. I circled the house, checking them all, closing the windows that Everett had insisted on opening, and wedging the kitchen chair under the handle of the back door with the broken lock. Everything felt slow and labored, even my breathing. It was this heat, the damn air conditioning unit that still wasn't fixed. I dragged myself to the kitchen. I needed a drink. Something cold, caffeinated. I bent over and stuck my head in the fridge, debating my choices. Water, Gatorade, cans of soda. I sank to my knees in front of the open door, breathing in the cold air. Wake up, Nick. As the electricity hummed in my ear and the fridge light illuminated the space around me. There was a sudden, high-pitched cry as the chair scraped against the floor. The back door swung open as I spun around, my back to the open refrigerator, my hands grasping for anything I could use to defend myself. Tyler stood in the open doorway, his arms trembling, covered in sweat and dirt, and something that smelled like earth and pollen. His body shook like he was wound tight with adrenaline and was fighting to keep himself still. He frowned at the chair, toppled on its side, and then scanned the room behind me. "Tyler? What are you doing?" His brown work boots were coated in a thick layer of mud, and he braced an arm against the doorframe. I pulled myself upright and shut the fridge, and the house settled into an uncomfortable silence. "Tyler, what's going on? Say something."
"Is anyone here?"
he asked, and I knew he didn't mean just anyone. "He left," I said. His arms were still shaking. "It's just me." He was not okay. This was Tyler at 15 when we all went to the service for his brother, and the folded American flag was placed on his mother's lap, and he appeared to be sitting perfectly still, but if you looked closer, you could see his entire body was trembling. I was so sure he was on the edge of cracking into a thousand pieces, and all the strangers pushing closer and closer to him were making it worse. This was Tyler at 17 on the day we got together for real, when I scraped my car door against his, and at first he looked so tense, all coiled up adrenaline, before he noticed me holding my breath, waiting for his reaction.
"Just a piece of metal,"
he'd said. "It's just us," I whispered. He took a step inside, and pieces of caked dirt settled on the linoleum floor.
"I'm sorry,"
he mumbled, seeing what he was doing to the floor. "Where have you been?" I asked. But he was focused on his shoes and the mud on the floor. I was scared he was going to leave, that he'd leave and disappear and I'd never see him again. "Here," I said, kneeling in front of him, prying at the muddy laces of his work boots. His breathing was ragged, and up close, I could see a fine yellow powder clinging to his pants. I concentrated on keeping my hands steady, trying to settle the growing unease. Tyler. This was just Tyler. I had one shoe unknotted when my phone on the table rang, making us both jump. Tyler watched me move across the room while he took off his other boot. "It's my brother," I said, frowning at the phone display. Tyler's face mirrored mine. I held the phone to my ear.
"Nick,"
Daniel said before I'd even said hello.
"Tell me where you are."
"I'm home, Daniel."
"Are you with Everett?"
he asked, and I could hear wind through the phone. He was moving. Fast. "No," I said. "He left. Tyler's here." I looked over at Tyler, who had taken another step closer. He was halfway across the room, his head tilted to the side like he was trying to hear the conversation.
"Listen to me,"
Daniel said as the engine came to life in the background.
"Get out."
My stomach dropped, and I looked at Tyler's boots once more.
"Get out. Now."
My hand dropped to my side. "Tyler?" I asked as the phone slipped from my hand, cracked as it made contact with the floor. Pollen, I thought. Earth.
"What? What did he say?"
Tyler said, his words quiet and laced with panic. I looked at his hands, at the dirt caked under his nails, at the thin line of dried blood running between his thumb and pointer finger. "Tyler," I said, "what did you do?" He leaned against a chair, his fingers pressing into the wood.
I'm running out of time, Nick.
And then I heard it, faint and far away, the high-pitched call of a siren. Tick-tock, Nick. What happened? I asked. He squeezed his eyes shut, and a slow tremor made its way through his body.
They found a body at Johnson Farm.
The field of sunflowers. Pollen. Earth. The siren growing insistent. Tyler coming closer. And time standing perfectly, painfully still. It's just a thing we created. A measure of distance. A way to understand. A way to explain things. It can weave around and show you things if you let it. Let it. The day before. Day 14. Time had gotten away from me. I'd been searching through the boxes of Dad's old books and teaching material while waiting for Everett to fall asleep, pulling scraps of paper from between the pages, checking the margins for comments. It must have been well after midnight, and I wasn't finding anything meaningful. Simpler and safer to trash it all. I stacked the boxes out in the hall to bring them down to the garage in the morning. The sound of rustling sheets carried through the open doorway, and I silently padded back to my bedroom in bare feet. Everett was sprawled across the middle of my bed, the yellow comforter discarded and crumpled on the floor beside him. He wasn't the deepest sleeper, but now his breathing was slow and measured. I placed my hand on his shoulder, and his back rose and fell in the same steady rhythm. The clock on the nightstand said 3:04. Perfect. This was the empty gap, that time when everyone went to sleep, when the last stragglers headed home from Kelly's pub, and the earliest risers were up, when the newspaper delivery began. The world was silent and waiting. I left the room, stepping over the piece of flooring that squeaked, tiptoeing across the wooden floor to my parents' old room, to the bedroom closet with the worn-out slippers and ratty shoes and work clothes that my dad would never need again. I slid my hand inside one slipper, where I'd hidden the key until I could check, until I could be sure what it was for. I felt the imprint of a foot in the matted fake fur. The key was cold in my grasp, and in the dark I couldn't see the intricate patterns on the rectangular metal keychain. But I could feel them, infinitely swirling, closing in on one another as I tightened my fist around it. Tick-tock, Nick. My sneakers waited beside the back door, and I felt a gust of chilled air brush against my arms. Everett must have opened the downstairs windows again. I hopped on the counter and pushed the windows back down, flipping the locks. And then I was gone. These woods are mine. These were the woods I grew up with. They stretched from my home and wove through all of town, connecting everything, all the way down to the river and out to the caverns. It had been years, but if I stopped thinking so much and moved by heart, I could follow countless paths through them, day or night. They were mine, and I was theirs, and I shouldn't have to remind myself of it. But now there were too many unknowns. The scurrying of animals in the night. Something so unsettling about the nocturnal. About things that needed the dark to survive. Things breathing and growing and dying. Everything in perpetual motion. These woods are mine. I ran my fingers along the tree trunks as I walked, as I repeated the words to myself. These were the woods I used to sneak through in the middle of the night to see Tyler, who'd park his truck in the lot of the convenience store and meet me halfway, at a clearing my brother showed me when I was younger. Daniel and I once built a fort there out of tree branches and lined the perimeter with thorny vines to keep the monster out, he had said. The storm that had swept through when I was in middle school destroyed the fort, and Daniel was too old to care by that point, so the clearing became mine and mine alone. But these were also the woods where Annalise was last seen. These were the woods we searched 10 years ago for Corinne, the woods we searched again last week. I was out here alone, in that empty gap of time when only the nocturnal and people craving the darkness roamed. My flashlight skimmed over the shadows, the branches hanging low and the roots reaching up from the earth, and something small and fast darting away as I approached. I stopped worrying so much about staying quiet, my footsteps growing louder as I moved faster. I broke through the tree line, now firmly on Carter property. The studio where Annalise had been living while applying to grad school for the last year was dark and set back from the main house. Neither was particularly large, but they'd been kept up well enough if you didn't count the yard or the shingles. The main house had the outside lights on as if they were expecting Annalise to return at any moment. Her place was once a standalone garage, before her father renovated it into an art studio years later. "My daughter has so much promise," he'd told my dad. But that was before he lost his job. "Downsizing," he'd said, sitting on the back porch with my dad, drinks in hand. Before the divorce. "She gets the goddamn house. Been in my family, and she gets the goddamn house." Before he left for a job in either Minnesota or Mississippi, I could never remember. Back when promise was a thing that felt real. We'd almost done the same thing to our garage for Daniel years earlier. Finding a place to live in Coulee Ridge wasn't as easy as it was up north. There's not a constant inventory of apartments turning over, and most rentals are occupied for years at a time. There were apartments over the stores on the main drag, and basements to rent out, and trailers you could lease and park on other people's land for a price. So when Daniel decided to stay, he thought converting the garage would be the cheapest option. Ellison Construction, Tyler's father's company, was going to do the job, but my dad and Daniel would help out to defray some of the cost. They built a carport between the garage and the house before starting, and they got as far as laying a new concrete layer over the unfinished garage floor, leaving space for the pipes. But they never got to the insulation or the plumbing. Corinne disappeared, and the world halted. Daniel changed his mind about how to spend that money, opting to live with Dad until years later, when he purchased his own place with Laura. I was guessing Annalise knew better than to put down permanent roots in Coulee Ridge. She left once, after all. She left and came back, and I bet she and Coulee Ridge didn't know what to do with each other anymore. This apartment was hers now, but next it could belong to her brother, who was in high school. "Just for now," I could imagine her saying any time it came up. "Just until the right opportunity comes along. Just until I find my way." A driveway snaked from the road to the side wall, from when it was a garage. Annalise's car and two others were lined up under the extra-wide carport beside the main house. I kept my flashlight off as I ran the remaining distance to her back door, the teeth of the key cutting into my palm. I took a breath and guided the key into the lock, each groove falling into place. My palm shook against the door as I turned the lock, the bolt sliding effortlessly open. My whole body tingled with anxiety when I stepped inside. I shouldn't be here. I turned the flashlight back on, keeping it low, away from the windows. The place looked a little like my apartment, with half walls to partition the rooms, but no doors. There was a queen bed with a white duvet in front of me, and an art desk pushed against the other wall, the supplies organized in containers, lined up in a perfectly straight row. Through the partition, I saw a couch across from a television attached to the wall. The whole place was sparsely furnished, but expertly done. Everything was understated and minimalistic, except the walls themselves. They were covered in art, in sketches, but even those looked like they were done in pencil or charcoal, the whole place completely devoid of color. I ran the flashlight from picture to picture. Framed sketches, Annalise's, I assumed, though some of them appeared to be replicas of famous pictures. Marilyn Monroe looking down and off to the side, standing against a brick wall. A little girl, her scraggly hair blowing across her face. I had seen this somewhere, but I couldn't place it. And there were some I didn't recognize at all. Didn't know whether they were copies or originals created by Annalise. Oh, but there was a theme. Girls. All alone. All of them. Girls looking exposed and sad and full of some longing. Girls passed over, passed by, staring out from the walls. Look. Look at us. Girls like Annalise on the telephone poles, silent and silenced. Annalise had gone to some well-known art school, which wasn't surprising. Back in middle school, she'd won a statewide photography competition, and that had made the local news. She looked the part, the girl on the other side of the camera, timid and fine-boned, with two wide eyes, every move tentative, careful, deliberate. The one creating, seeing, but never seen, the opposite of Corinne. I knew the cops had been here, but the place looked completely undisturbed. There obviously hadn't been a struggle in the apartment. Besides, we know she went out walking. If she had been hurt, it hadn't happened here. Her purse was gone, but that could have been because she had it with her when she left. Her car was here. That was the big sign. Who leaves without her car? They hadn't found her cell phone, so the general consensus was that it was with her, wherever that was. And it was powered off, since they hadn't been able to trace it. The cops had been through here, and probably her parents, though I hadn't heard a thing about any evidence or clues. But this key was something real and solid and gut-twisting. This key was dangerous. I went through her desk, her closet, her bathroom cabinets, even the garbage can, remembering the pregnancy test they'd found at Corinne's, stuffed inside the box of Skittles. There was nothing here. A tissue, an empty stick of deodorant, the wrapper from a bar of soap. Though it was possible that someone had swept through here before the cops, cleaning up after her, saving her the embarrassment, letting her keep the parts of her that should have remained hidden. I checked her dresser drawers, everything neatly folded and everything hers. No men's clothes, no spare toothbrush beside the sink, no notes on her desk. Nothing at all there except the sleek laptop next to a bundle of wires. I chewed the side of my thumb. They'd probably already been through it. I could have it back before anyone noticed. I could. I grabbed it before I could change my mind. I checked under her bed on the way out. There was a suitcase. More potential evidence that she hadn't gone on a trip. And beside that, a white box that could hold a large photo album. I placed the laptop on the floor and slid the box out from under the bed. Lifting the top, I saw that it held the sketches that hadn't made it onto the wall. I flipped through them rapidly, the flashlight cold and metallic between my teeth, wondering if she'd stuffed anything else amid the drawings, something the cops missed, something she'd tried to keep hidden. But no, only art. More sad girls. Eyes open, eyes closed, all forlorn somehow. I had to squint to see their faces, their outlines so faint. Drafts, maybe. Sketches to darken and shade and bring depth to later. All blurring together as I turned them over faster and faster. But then I stopped, flipped back a few pictures. I took the flashlight from my mouth, ran the light over the familiar angles of the face, the curve of her smile, the freckle at the corner of her right eye, the bow shape of her mouth, and the flowing peasant dress that hit just above her knees. Corinne. It was a sketch of Corinne. No, it was a goddamn replica of a picture that had hung in my room. We had been in a field of sunflowers, Johnson Farm. It was only a few towns away, practically a tourist attraction. People driving from hours away to take pictures there. It was Bailey's favorite shoot location. This picture had been taken with Bailey's camera the summer before senior year. We'd taken at least 100 shots that day, posing beside each other for so long that we forgot we were posing. Bailey liked to make us spin as fast as we could, and she'd set the camera for long exposure, and after she got the film developed, we'd look like haunting, blurred images. Like ghosts. I never picked those pictures to keep. I hated how you couldn't tell us apart when we were spinning. I took the ones with us smiling, frozen-faced and happy, and I hung them on my walls, like proof. I had been in this picture, too. Corinne's eyes were closed, and she had a small smile caught between moments. She'd been telling us a story that I could no longer remember, her hand brushing the top of a waist-high sunflower. I'd stood beside her, watching her, laughing. This was my favorite picture of us. But Annalise had sketched only Corinne. She'd left me behind when she transferred Corinne and filled the white space I'd occupied with sunflowers. I was gone, removed from the memory. an unnecessary complication easily excised. Without me in it, Corinne looked lonely and sad, like every other girl in this box. I moved the page aside, and there was another behind it, another sketch of one of my pictures, this time of Corinne and Bailey and me. Again, the sketch was just Corinne, staring forlornly to the side. We'd both been looking at Bailey in the picture, at her twirling with her head back and her white skirt flying up around her dark legs. Now it was Corinne, alone in a field of sunflowers. How the hell did Annalise get my pictures? She must have been in my house. She must have been in my room. Who was this girl I'd lived beside for years? Annalise was 5 years younger, and we barely noticed her back then. Noticed her even less because she was a quiet kid, and the times I remembered her, she'd been in that awkward phase between kid and adolescent, skinny and unsure of herself. This was all I knew of her. Her parents sent her over with food for a solid 3 months after my mother died, and she never seemed to know what to say when she brought it over, so she never said anything at all. She didn't have a lot of friends, I didn't think, because any time I remembered seeing her, she'd been alone. She won that photography contest, but I'd known about it only because Bailey had entered it too. And she liked strawberry ice cream, or she liked it enough to be eating it at the county fair 10 years ago. She'd been standing by herself near the entrance as I ran from the Ferris wheel. I hadn't seen her at first. I'd seen only Tyler waiting for me. It wasn't until Daniel hit me so hard that I dropped to my side, until I untwisted my arm and turned my head away and saw her face frozen behind a melting scoop of strawberry ice cream, her tongue still out, halfway up the cone. I heard a fist collide with flesh, something snap, and I didn't have to look to know exactly what it was. Annalise's ice cream scoop fell off the cone, and she ran out the front entrance. I turned my head the other way in time to see the drops of blood collecting on the ground as Daniel bent over, his hands cupped over his nose, and Tyler cursing to himself, shaking out his hand. I slid the box back under the bed, but I folded the sketches of Corinne and tucked them inside the laptop. They were almost mine anyway.
Nicolette?
Everett was sitting on the side of my bed this morning as I stared at the empty space where the pictures once hung on my walls.
What are you doing?
Just thinking. I opened the top drawer and pulled out a change of clothes. I'd hidden the laptop and the sketches in my dad's closet, along with that damn key, before sneaking back into bed. But his eyes had opened as I slid under the sheets, and I'd felt him staring at the side of my face as I rolled over.
Did you sleep at all? I woke up and you weren't here.
A little. I couldn't get to sleep for a while, so I did some more packing. I walked into the bathroom and turned on the shower, hoping Everett would drop it.
I heard you,
he said. He was standing in the doorway, watching me squeeze toothpaste on my toothbrush. I started brushing my teeth and raised my eyebrows at him, buying myself some time.
I heard you come in. What were you doing out there?
He gestured through the walls to the woods. Everett grew up in a city where a girl wandering the streets at night wasn't safe, where woods were unfamiliar or dangerous, or an adventure to be shared with friends and a tent and a six-pack of lukewarm beer. I spat into the sink and said, "Just taking a walk, clearing my mind." I felt him in the room, taking up space, and I held my breath. He knew how to get to the truth. It was his goddamn job. If he wanted, he could push from every different angle until I cracked in half. He was very good at what he did. But he let it drop.
I need to spend the morning at the library, he said. Can I take the car?
Anytime he needed the internet, he had to go there. The house didn't even have a phone line. No problem. I'll drop you off. I watched the water circling the sink drain, my mind on the other side of the trees, searching through Annalise's drawings. Everett was beside me then, and he pulled my chin so I was facing him, the toothbrush sticking out of my mouth. I jerked back. What? I said. His hand dropped, but his gaze held, the corners of his mouth tipping down.
You look exhausted,
he said.
Your eyes are all bloodshot.
I looked away, put the toothbrush down and started stripping for the shower, hoping he'd focus on something else.
You know, you can take something to help. To sleep. We'll go to the doctor tomorrow.
In charge. Taking over. Making the plan. Averting the crisis. The steam slowly began to fill the room. Even as he backed away, he was looking into my eyes. I pulled the car up to the library entrance, which looked like a library only if you knew what you were looking for. It was once a Victorian home, two stories with bay windows and a wraparound porch. It had been partially renovated, walls knocked down to open up the spaces, but the creaky stairs and heavy banister and single bathrooms remained. "How long do you need?" I asked.
"Sorry, I'll probably be most of the day. We go to trial next week."
"Didn't take the plea?" He cut his eyes to me.
"You're not supposed to know about that."
"I'm never supposed to know. Didn't stop me from asking, though. A few nights before I left for here, I was trying to finish all the school counselor documentation for the end of the year. I'd sat across from Everett at the table while he worked, the contents of his briefcase strewn across the entire tabletop. I'd run my fingers across his papers, the highlighted lines, the notes in the margins. "Parlito case?" I'd asked. There was a phone trace he was trying to get thrown out, and if I was reading it right, there was a proposed plea bargain. He had grinned and stacked the papers back up, reached under the table at my legs resting on the chair beside him, and squeezed my calf. I ask every time. It's a game at this point. He never tells. Truth is, I love that he doesn't. That he is both good at what he does and good to the core. "Call me when you're ready," I said, squinting from the glare through the windshield. He grabbed my elbow before opening his car door.
"Make an appointment to see a doctor, Nicolette."
Sometimes when I'm not focused, I'll end up someplace I had no intention of going. Like muscle memory. Head to the store but end up at school. Walk to the bank, end up at the subway. Drive to Daniel's but find myself in front of Corinne's old place. Which must have been what just happened and how I ended up parked on the corner by Kelly's pub, even though I had every intention of heading home. My eyes drifted over the storefront, over the awning, to the window a floor up with the air conditioning unit hanging over the edge. The blinds were open. I needed to talk to him about that key anyway, and he wasn't answering my calls. Not that I really blamed him. I pushed through the entrance into the vestibule area of Kelly's pub and cringed as the bell chimed overhead. At least at night there was too much noise to notice. I could smell smoke and grease and something stale underneath as I passed the open doorway inside on the way to the narrow stairwell.
"He's not here,"
someone called, and the sound of laughter drifted out from the darkened room. I took the steps two at a time to the alcove with a door on either side, facing the one on the right. I knocked rapidly three times, waited, and tried again, pressing my ear to the door. Then I called from my cell, my ear still pressed to the door, and heard the periodic vibration of his phone from somewhere inside, until the voicemail picked up.
"Hey, this is Tyler. Leave a message."
Maybe he was in the shower. I tried to listen for the sound of water in pipes or any movement inside. I called again. The vibration, the voicemail, and nothing else. Another round of laughter from downstairs. I checked the time on my phone. 1 p.m. on a Sunday. The new 5 p.m. I used to find my dad here during summer break, but not this early. Never this early. I turned to go, but the creeping feeling that I was being watched started at the back of my neck, worked its way down my spine. The stairwell was empty. The door at the bottom was closed. I listened for movement somewhere nearby. A shuffling in the walls. A breath in the vents. There was a shadow in the tiny strip of light escaping from the apartment door across the hall, but it hadn't moved. I stepped closer, keeping my movement as quiet as possible. Could be the angle, sunlight and furniture, but I stared at the peephole, leaning closer, my own face distorting in the reflection, like a funhouse mirror, two big eyes and two small mouth and everything elongated and sickly. I knocked once, Softly, but the shadow didn't move. The tiny hairs on the back of my neck stood on end. I closed my eyes, counted to 10. This was what happened during an investigation. You felt eyes everywhere. You became suspicious of everyone. Everything fell apart if you didn't hold yourself together. Hold it together. I jogged back downstairs, my footsteps echoing in the hollow underneath the steps, and walked through the bar entrance. A crowd of faces I vaguely recognized glanced in my direction, and one man leaned over to say something to another. I watched his lips move. That's Patrick Farrell's daughter. And the other man tilted a bottle of beer to his lips. I tried to catch the bartender's eye, but either he didn't see me or he didn't care. Probably the latter. I knocked on the bar top. "Jackson," I said, trying to keep my voice low. He came closer, the muscles and sinew of his forearm straining as he cleaned and stacked the dishes behind the bar, before fixing his bloodshot green eyes on me.
"Yes, Nick?"
"Who lives in the other apartment upstairs?" I asked, across from Tyler. The skin at the corners of his eyes tightened as he looked me over, and he rubbed a tan hand over the dark scruff on his face.
"I do. Why?"
I shook my head. "No reason. I had to get home. Had to check the laptop. Had to get it back inside Annalise's place before anyone went looking for it." He narrowed his eyes as he gave my entire body a quick skim.
"Sit down, Nick,"
he said.
"You look like you could use it."
Jackson poured a shot into a glass with lip smudge marks from the last customer visible on the rim.
"Vodka, right? On the house."
My stomach churned, and I pushed it back in his direction across the sticky surface. "I gotta go." He grabbed my wrist, tried to hide the grip under a playful smile.
"There's a blue car,"
he said, facing away from everyone.
"I've seen it pass 3 times in the last half hour. You're not the only one looking for Tyler. He's been gone all weekend."
Gone all weekend. Except his phone was here. "I was just in the area," I said.
"Sure you were."
I wondered if Jackson knew anything more, but his face gave nothing away. He tilted his head, his fingers circling my wrist. A man at the far end of the bar raised his glass, a friend of my dad's, or at least someone he used to drink here with. He had a sprinkling of gray hair and cheeks that burned bright red like apples.
"Regards to your father, hon. You okay?"
His eyes slid to Jackson's hand, then back to me. "Yes, I'm fine," I said, pulling my arm away. Jackson frowned, downed the shot, and slammed it back on the counter.
"Something's about to happen, Nick. You can feel that, right?"
Like static in the air, a net closing, a car circling, 2 weeks of digging into the past, and all the lies were rising to the surface. Annalise goes missing, and the box of Corinne's evidence is shaken up, tipped over. All the names fall out again. I was at the front door when I saw it, the blue sedan, tinted windows, rolling slowly down the block. I waited for it to pass before walking to my car. Annalise's laptop had no password protection, which I found slightly odd, but maybe not unexpected if she lived by herself in the middle of nowhere. Or maybe the police had hacked into it, leaving it unsecured. I scanned through the folders of college projects and grad school applications, sorting by date last modified to see if there was anything new or potentially relevant. Then I did the same with her pictures. The photos weren't sorted by anything other than date, time-stamped from as long as 5 years ago to as recent as 3 weeks ago. I lingered on one of Tyler in his truck, his mouth slightly open, his hand slightly raised. "Smile," she says. He puts a hand up to wave or to block her shot. A frozen moment. 100 different possibilities existing all at once. And most recently, a few shots from this year's fair. The Ferris wheel looming. Empty carts. Lights glowing in the dusk. A child eating cotton candy, his mouth sticky with pink sugar, the wisps of cotton melting as soon as they touched his lips. Vendors reaching with change or hot dogs, their fingers starting to unfurl, and the people on the other side looking toward their children or over their shoulders, already half turned away. I could picture Annalise standing there like when she was a kid, a bystander to the story, watching other lives play out. I closed the images and quickly scanned the files and saw the discrepancy. The image file names were in numerical order, but there were a few jumps, a few gaps. The trash had been emptied. Could have been that Annalise didn't like how they'd turned out, but I couldn't shake the feeling that someone else had been through here, checking for something he or she didn't want seen. I jotted down the date range for the missing files, a chunk from 4 or 5 months ago. By the time Everett called to be picked up from the library, I'd searched every corner of the computer, found the portfolios that she must have scanned in and photos of her artwork. I'd checked the list of last visited websites, which were mostly school websites or job boards. Where the hell are you, Annalise? I wiped down the keyboard and the rest of the laptop and slid her key into the front pocket of my shorts, the metal still hot from the sunlight. I'd store both in Dad's closet until it was night again, and the world was sleeping, and silent, and waiting. I could probably fit all of my conversations with Annalise into the span of an hour, yet I had an odd, intangible connection to her, tied to my sharpest memories. Because in that box, the one I imagined in the corner of the police station hidden just out of reach, her name will forever be tied to ours. The cops had interviewed each of us, asking about that night, about why Daniel had a broken nose and why Tyler had scraped up knuckles, and why I looked like someone had knocked me around. It was Tyler who remembered.
"That Carter girl,"
he'd told the cops.
"Begins with an A. She was there. She saw us."
I imagine they questioned her, and I imagine she confirmed our story because they never asked again. Annalise had been our alibi. The day before. Day 13. "Everett's here," I said. I stood facing the corner of the bathroom, mumbling into the phone with the shower running in the background.
"Everett's where?"
Daniel responded. Steam filled the room, the mirror coated with a fine layer of fog.
"Here."
I looked over my shoulder. "In my bedroom. I called him about Dad, and he showed up yesterday to help. He is helping." I could hear Laura in the background, something about paint fumes and pregnancy and open the damn window, which made me love her a little in that moment.
"Okay, good. That's good."
A pause, and I imagined him walking away from Laura.
"What did you tell him?"
I cracked the door, and the steam escaped into my bedroom, wisps curling up toward the vents. Everett was still sprawled face down on the bed. I had my money on a hangover. I eased the door shut, walked across the tiny bathroom out through the other door to Daniel's old room. "I told him the truth, Daniel, that the police were trying to question Dad in the disappearance of a girl 10 years ago, regardless of his mental state. He marched down to the police station and Grand Pines, threatening legal action if it happened again."
"It's done? Is that it?"
"He needs to follow up on Monday, get some paperwork from the doctor or something, but they'll back off until then."
"So he's staying through Monday?"
"Looks that way." I heard Laura again. "Who's staying through Monday?" And then everything sounded muffled, like Daniel was covering the phone with his hand. He cleared his throat.
"Laura wants you to bring him by for dinner tonight."
"Tell her thanks, but..."
"Great. 6 o'clock, Nick."
I didn't wake Everett until nearly noon, and only then because his work was stacked in the middle of the dining room table, and I knew he had to make up for the time lost yesterday. I nudged him on the shoulder and held the over-the-counter painkillers in one hand, a glass of water in the other. He moaned as he rolled over, his gaze roaming around my room as he tried to orient himself. "Hey there," I said, crouching beside the bed, trying to hide my smile. I liked Everett in the morning most of all, when he was lazy and malleable, when his thoughts lagged a few seconds behind. He always looked surprised while his mind caught up to what was happening, before the caffeine hit his bloodstream and he sharpened into focus. I liked him even better on the rare mornings he'd wake in my apartment and sit up and fumble for the alarm on his phone, misjudging the distance to my nightstand, confused by the studio apartment and the painted furniture.
"Hey,"
he said, then winced. He propped himself up on his elbows and downed the painkillers before flopping back onto the mattress. Want to sleep it off some more? He peered at the clock, threw an arm over his eyes.
Ugh. No.